This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. 6 months after news of bogus accounts at Wells Fargo surfaced, the bank is still trying to leave the scandal in the dust. High-ranking managers have been fired, while other brass, including the new CEO, have taken a compensation hit. A Charlotte-based executive is overseeing reforms and says changes are taking hold, but more work remains. The bank will issue the results of its own internal investigation sometime in April, but the federal government is also looking into what happened and who knew what when. How close is the bank to being through with all of this? Will other shoes drop before that happens? Could there be criminal charges? We get an update this hour from two reporters who have been following this story since almost the very beginning. Dion Roberts is a banking reporter with the Charlotte Observer. He joins us in our Spirit Square studio once again. And with us by phone from Los Angeles is Emily Glazer, a banking reporter with the Wall Street Journal. She is the reporter who broke the story about Wells Fargo's illegal sales practices nationwide. Thank you both for being here. Good morning. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mike.
You're welcome. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can do it via email, charlottetalks@wfae.org, search for WFAE on Facebook, or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. Emily, let me begin with you. How did you uncover this?
Well, so the Los Angeles Times had done some fantastic reporting back in 2012 and 2013. I started writing about banks just a couple years ago, focusing on Wells Fargo and J.P. Morgan, and an editor at the Wall Street Journal had told me to go read those stories and write about things like that. So I was pretty hot on the case from late 2014, and back in November 2015, I got wind that regulators were finally probing and investigating this around Wells Fargo's sales practices, and we started there, and then that sort of led to a lot of reporting over the course of 2016 and working on quite a big story follow-up, and then got wind of the settlement. So we scrapped that story, raced to write about the settlement the night before that it was announced. And from there, it sort of became a massive domino effect of how it unfolded, all of the political pressure, the regulators piling up, and, of course, turmoil inside the company.
This is all about helping to build the bank's portfolio by having sales associates create these accounts, bogus accounts, and whether or not they were deliberately created or they were told to create them, that's probably still in question, but these employees did. They created these bogus accounts, checking accounts, credit card accounts, and Forbes magazine reports that the practice seemed to stem from former Wells CEO John Stumpf's mantra, eight is great, meaning get eight Wells Fargo products into the hands of each customer. Almost all businesses and all banks do cross-selling, Dion. How did this get out of hand?
Well, actually, the cross-selling practice dates to Dick Kovacevic, who worked for Norwest, which was a company that acquired Wells Fargo, and so that's John Stumpf's predecessor. But cross-selling is, you're right, it's used across different industries, and particularly in retail. But what happened at Wells Fargo, regulators said, is it was just a poorly managed incentive system where, you know, the bank was pushing for eight products essentially per household, and, you know, employees were feeling incredible pressure to meet those goals or they would get fired. Mm. And so what you had were people, you know, according to the regulators, opening up accounts in the names of customers without their permission and without their knowledge. These were checking accounts and credit card accounts, and when you add it all up, it was about 2.1 million accounts that regulators say may not have been authorized by customers.
Yeah, 2.1 million accounts, 1.5 million unauthorized deposit accounts, 500,000 unauthorized credit card applications. It generated, I think, $2.6 million in fees for the bank. And in the scheme of things, in a bank that size, $2.6 million doesn't seem like very much. I mean, how could anybody say it was worth it, Emily?
Well, so I think Warren Buffett said it best. When the scandal sort of broke and erupted back in September, Buffett, who is the largest shareholder, sort of remained mum for a while, kept mum. And then he finally spoke out and said this is way more about reputational damage than about, $185 million fine or some of these numbers that are truly pennies to a bank that at one point had the largest market value in the world. But I think the reason why it happened and why people did it was largely because part of what Dion said, they were scared of being fired, but also there were these lofty sales goals that would lead to bonuses. Maybe it would be a couple $100, maybe a couple thousand. And if you're making, you know, $30,000 to $60,000 a year, that could have a really big impact on your salary.
Yeah.
At the same time, it wasn't just lower-level employees. It was mid-level and higher-ups who were also getting bonuses based on the numbers that they were bringing in for the bank, and also who were seen as, you know, heroes inside the bank for raising these numbers.
But executives at the 30,000-foot level could see, and they didn't care about the bonus compensation packages that the lower-level employees were getting because it was peanuts to them, but they could see what this was bringing in, and it wasn't really all that much money. So why put the bank at risk?
It's a great question and one that we've been digging into so much. I think that while there's still questions around who at the top knew and how much, and that will come out hopefully with some of the board's investigation report that is due out before the bank's annual shareholder meeting on April 25th, the closest that I think we can get so far based on who has been fired, which are about three levels below the CEO. There were four top executives fired a couple weeks ago. Since then, different executives who are a few levels lower have been fired as well. They still did get bonuses based on the successful results of their region. And so while it wouldn't make the overall bank more money, since these were not real accounts, they weren't being funded, they weren't being used. In fact, the bank lost money from accounts like this. There were still internal aspects where perhaps the regional executive overseeing Los Angeles or, you know, California or Arizona was certainly getting more money and certainly getting promoted throughout the organization because it seemed like they were increasing their numbers over time.
Now, we said at the beginning that 2.1 million customers were probably affected by this. Is that the new number? Because evidently there was an original number, original estimate, and recently it has been uncovered that more people than anticipated were actually affected by this.
That's right. So on March 1st, Wells Fargo, for the first time, said that the number of customers affected by the scandal could be higher than previously thought, meaning, I suppose, more than that 2.1 million. You know, the bank said it could discover these more potentially affected customers as its reviews continue, as it continues to go back and all the way to 2010 and 2009 to see, you know, what activity was happening then. There again, though, it noted and made sure to note to investors when it disclosed this in a securities filing on March 1st that the remediation costs for those customers are not expected to have a significant financial impact on Wells Fargo.
This, as Dion just said, Emily, started, we think, around 2009 in some form or fashion. How did it go on so long unnoticed?
You know, I actually think it started way earlier than that.
Wow.
We had a pretty big front page story a couple days after the settlement erupted, and there were examples that we have going back to 2002. Especially at least the mid-2000s is where I'd feel comfortable saying it was fairly widespread in certain geographic regions, particularly Southern California. Why did it go on so long? That is a great question. I think that there were too many mid-level executives that were turning a blind eye. I think that there were problems with the bank's risk and compliance function, that they were not catching this. And I think that inside the bank, it really wasn't viewed as a big problem back in the, you know, around the 2011-2012 time.
Well, you wrote in January that one reason could have been that bank branches were given a heads up before Wells Fargo's internal monitors came in for inspections. The bank's own, their bank's own inspectors, they were warned that they were coming and they cleaned up their act.
Yeah, that was a pretty wild one to find out about. And basically, yeah, we heard about a lot of different branch bankers who would get a heads up. It was almost like a bad game of telephone where different local branches would get heads up from folks that were going to come in for these reviews. And basically, they would also get a heads up sometimes about what was being found in other nearby branches. It was a skewed system that didn't work, and the bank has since said that they changed that. Of course, over the years, there were more parts of the review that were done electronically, so you couldn't fudge as much of it, but it was still, in my eyes, I think, a big problem on how folks were able to hide their behavior. But I do truly think that a big part of this was that the bank didn't wake up to it fast enough, and throughout this reporting, to me, it's often been a too little, too late type of mentality until, I think, more recently with so many different changeovers in management and the way that the bank has approached what's going on.
We're going to talk about what's been going on to investigate this, where it stands, what may happen next, and where how this may resolve itself as we go through the hour. Emily Glazer is with us, banking reporter for the Wall Street Journal, and Dion Roberts, banking reporter for the Charlotte Observer. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about Wells Fargo and where the investigation into the bogus accounts is right now and where it may lead. And we're talking about that with two banking reporters, Emily Glazer with the Wall Street Journal, who joins us from Los Angeles this morning. She helped break this story nationally. Dion Roberts is a banking reporter with the Charlotte Observer. And during Senate investigations, Senator Elizabeth Warren, Dion, told former Wells CEO John Stumpf that he should resign and that he should be criminally investigated by the Department of Justice and the Securities and Exchange Commission. He did resign. Has he been investigated by the SEC?
Well, we don't know, you know, who specifically is being investigated. What we do know is that the bank is facing state and federal investigations, including from U.S. attorneys here in North Carolina and California. The Securities and Exchange Commission and the U.S. Department of Labor are also investigating. But again, it's hard to know exactly, you know, which executive or executives or employees are being investigated over this. What we do know, and we found this out last week from talking to sources, here in Charlotte, federal investigators have begun interviewing bank examiners. So these are federal employees who go in and they examine branches and make sure that, you know, banks are following the laws and things like that. So it sounds like things are maybe sort of heating up.
So does the fact that they are interviewing bank examiners, these are people who do not work for banks. They do not work for Wells Fargo.
Correct.
Is that some kind of a suspicion or that perhaps they were looking the other way?
Well, what that could indicate, and this is just speculation because we haven't heard directly from investigators on this, but it could mean that they're looking to see, did the bank hide any information about the scandal from regulators? And also, did the bank hide any information? Did the executives, did the managers hide any information from the bank's own board members?
Okay. Does that seem likely, Emily? I mean, your story in January reported that some bank employees, when they knew that the internal examiners, the bank's own internal examiners, would be showing up at a bank branch, they would get a warning. And these employees would work late into the night. Sometimes they would go through desk drawers, you wrote, and they would find these bogus account cards opening new accounts for customers without signatures. And then they would quickly copy and paste the signature on file onto the card so that when the internal examiners got there, it would look all right. So is it possible that this did happen?
That in addition to shredding papers, there were a lot of fishy things going on then. I think, you know, I don't want to speculate too much. I think Dion put it quite well. Right now, this is with the Department of Justice around 6 months into the stages of their investigation. We had reported back around mid-September that both in Charlotte, the Southern District of New York, and the Northern District of California were in the early stages of looking into and probing the sales practices at Wells Fargo. Prosecutors had issued subpoenas to the bank for documents and materials, and these investigations take a while. So 6 months means, you know, I'd imagine, just as Dion had reported in a great story, that it is moving along and they're interviewing more people, but my guess is that they don't know yet what exactly happened, and they're trying to figure it out. And that's probably also in tandem with what information will come out to the public about the board's investigation, which I'd imagine the board has to be, and the bank has said they're cooperating with regulators, so they have to be sharing that with them as well. In terms of the SEC investigation, we had reported in early November that the SEC was looking into whether the bank had violated rules around investor disclosures, and other matters relating to its sales tactic scandal. And in particular, there were a lot of questions around why top executives like former CEO John Stumpf, but also former CFO and now CEO Timothy Sloan, you know, where they were around disclosing a lot of different pieces of the sales practices issues, from the fact that they were being probed, which most banks usually do disclose in securities filings, to even the regulators furthering, you know, investigations and more piling on. More recently, the bank has been a lot more transparent and has issued more disclosures. But as we've talked about, for years, there was nothing. And so I think that's been a pretty big focus of the SEC investigation. But given that that one was likely starting a little bit later than the Department of Justice, it's hard to tell how far along they are or when it might wrap up.
Let me ask either of you if you know the answer to this question, because all of the U.S. attorneys around the country were recently asked to resign, and the guy in New York was fired because he refused to resign. What impact, and that's not necessarily out of the ordinary for U.S. attorneys to be replaced when an administration changes in Washington, but what impact might that have on this investigation? And given who has ended up in the Trump cabinet, could that make for a less aggressive investigation into this going forward?
I can speak to the U.S. attorney piece, I think. So here in Charlotte, we don't face the same situation that, you know, we see in New York with mm-hmm. the U.S. attorney for the Southern District who was asked to resign and then was gone, I think, as of Friday, last Friday. We don't have that situation here in Charlotte because our current U.S. attorney was, I think, an assistant U.S. attorney who filled the position of the previous U.S. attorney, and so wasn't exactly appointed by Obama, if that makes sense. So I think, and that's Jill Rose. So Jill Rose will is expected to remain in her job for now. And I think the same situation is going on in San Francisco, where the U.S. attorney there is looking into Wells Fargo. So I don't think those two U.S. attorneys are in the same situation that Preet Bharara, who is in New York, found himself in.
But could the, and I don't know if you know the answer to this, could the Trump administration be less aggressive in their approach toward this? Or would that look politically, would that be good politics?
I can hop in here. I think with Preet Bharara, I know the Wall Street Journal recently reported that the person who will be filling in for him was basically his deputy. So in our reporting for the paper, a lot of folks don't think that his investigation will change drastically. However, I think the Trump effect is one that certainly the stock market has been aware of and traded on. You know, when the new president and his various members of his administration have been announced and some potential policy changes have come to the fore, certainly Wells Fargo and the whole banking sector stock prices have risen. And some people believe that could be because there is the sense that the regulation may be loosening a bit for banks. It also could be because of the, you know, rising interest rates. It also could be because of changes in corporate tax reform. So there really are a bevy of reasons. Mm-hmm. But one of them, and a main one, is that there's a sense that regulation will finally start to slow down a little bit, and maybe banks won't be on the hot seat nearly as much as they have been under the Obama administration.
How widespread was this cross-selling practice and the opening of bogus accounts in Charlotte or in this region of the Wells Fargo footprint?
Yeah. I don't have those numbers in front of me right now, but you know, it was taking place here. It was definitely taking place in Charlotte.
Because they took over Wachovia. When Wachovia failed during the height of the banking situation in 2008, they came in on their white horse and drove their stagecoach down Tryon Street and took over. And it, evidently, it was a clash of corporate cultures because Wachovia was a very conservative, well-run organization, very customer-focused, I understand. And Wells Fargo is slightly different, and certainly with these sales practices, they were very different. Did you, as a reporter who covers banking in Charlotte, were you getting rumblings from off-the-record rumblings from people about being a little dissatisfied or with the approach that Wells Fargo was taking?
Well, I I didn't get any calls or emails from sources. I started covering banking in Charlotte in February 2013. But, you know, as Emily said, you know, the Los Angeles Times was reporting on this back in late 2013. And we've seen in some of the lawsuits that we've looked at since the scandal, you know, there were letters, Mike, that were being written directly to management at Wells Fargo going back to the mid, you know, 2000s, 2005, perhaps even earlier, from employees who were saying, you know, there's a problem with what we're doing. You know, we are not, you know, treating customers the way they should be treated. There are some shady practices going on here around sales. There were emails that were sent to John Stumpf. Some of those were discussed at the, you know, in front of Congress. So, you know, the bank, someone in the bank knew about this. Someone high up in the bank knew about this, you know, going back, you know, 5 years ago or more. And as you know, as Emily was talking about Warren Buffett, I mean, as Warren Buffett said, you know, in November on CNN, basically this was a great bank that made a terrible mistake.
Right.
He called it a dumb, quote unquote, dumb incentive system, which, quote, when they found out it was dumb, they didn't do anything about it.
Emily, in December, you wrote that the bank was trying to refund victims of these tactics, and that process has been tough going for the bank. Why?
Well, I'll just add one quick thing about the geographic breakdown.
Okay.
The bank had, just to go back to that briefly, the bank did release some numbers, or I believe senators actually released what the bank had sent them about where, which areas this was truly problematic in. And if I recall, I couldn't find them immediately at my fingertips, even though I have the perks of being next to a laptop right now. I don't think Charlotte was one of the hot spots. It was really Southern California, Arizona, Southern Florida, and the New Jersey area. And that's where it was really exploding, primarily Southern California. So I just wanted to hop in on that one. To switch tunes a little bit and talk about the refunding process, this is unprecedented. It is really wild what the bank has to go through in order to properly refund customers, even though in most cases it's a pretty small amount. And so what the bank has been saying publicly to investors, to its employees, is that it was really just an average of $25 a person. You know, it's the trust aspect that's far worse than the money. However, there are a lot of cases where the refunds are quite complicated, especially if you're looking at a hypothetical example of somebody whose credit score was impacted by the bank opening, say, a credit card in their name without their approval or acknowledgement, and that impacting their credit score so that when they went to get perhaps a mortgage, they had to pay more than they would have. It's quite complicated and many like layers to untangle, but that is part of what they're dealing with right now.
So will this go on for years? Because that's, I would think that's very difficult to prove, because the lending officer that maybe said, well, you got to pay more now because your credit score is not right, may not even be a lending officer anymore, may not be in the business anymore. So how would you prove that, and will there be lawsuits forthcoming?
As you can imagine, they have armies of people both internally at the bank and consultants going through massive reams of data. So it isn't so much about which loan officer could be at the bank or not. It's about what they have in their system. But what makes this even more complicated...
But it may not even be a loan officer at that bank. You may have tried to get a car loan or a mortgage someplace from somebody else, and they look at your credit score, which is affected by Wells Fargo, unbeknownst to you, and they charge you more.
Exactly. So then it's data from other banks. And then on top of that, even with Wells Fargo alone, and at most big banks, frankly, their systems don't talk to each other because these banks are made up of tons of mergers and acquisitions over the years with legacy technology systems that often are separated. So at Wells Fargo, for instance, we had reported that, you know, perhaps their mortgage data doesn't necessarily talk to the credit card data system. So in order to get a holistic picture of even just their own customers, it takes time. It's not something they could just pull up in minutes.
Wow. Go ahead, Neil.
I've got some numbers for you, Mike. So I had to just pull these up. So you were asking about...
I thought you were tweeting over there.
Nope, wasn't tweeting. Not that time, anyway. You were asking about the North Carolina, South Carolina. So I don't have... let me correct one thing I said. I said that, you know, Charlotte was impacted by the scandal. I don't know that for a fact, but it. I would say that it likely happened in Charlotte, and here's why. As many as 60,000 accounts in North Carolina and South Carolina may have been opened without customer consent, according to the bank. And that breaks down to around 38,700 in North Carolina and about 23,300 in South Carolina. So you figure some of those had to be in Charlotte. I mean, we're a big metropolitan area.
Dion Roberts is a banking reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Emily Glazer is a banking reporter who helped break this story nationally for the Wall Street Journal. We'll talk more about where we're going from here, where Wells Fargo is going from here, in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and we're talking about Wells Fargo and what's happening with Wells Fargo as their internal investigation proceeds and should be released sometime in April about what happened with these bogus accounts. Of course, April is also the month in which they will have their annual shareholders meeting in Florida. Dion Roberts is a banking reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Emily Glazer is a banking reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Obviously, Justice Department investigators want to know if executives shared everything they knew about these phony accounts with the bank's own board of directors and with the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. What would it mean if the board did or did not know? I'm not sure which of you to take that question. Dion?
Well, you know, the board's job, first and foremost, is to, you know, oversee the management and also to look out for shareholder interests. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that's come up since the scandal is that the bank did not disclose this earlier to investors. I mean, the whole world didn't hear about it until September 8th of last year. Under federal securities rules, Mike, companies must disclose material, quote-unquote material information, which basically means a matter that a reasonable investor would deem important in deciding whether to buy a stock. Now, keep in mind, since the scandal, billions of dollars were shaved off of Wells Fargo's market value. Right. Basically, you take the number of outstanding shares and you multiply that by the price of the shares. That's your market value. Shaved off billions of dollars in the wake of the scandal. Now, that's since been, you know, recouped as the stock market has gone back up again. But, you know, some investors were hurt by this, and there are lawsuits out there right now where investors are saying this was material. We should have known about this. And my reporting, Mike, I did a story a few months ago on the fact that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which is one of the regulators that fined Wells Fargo, we obtained emails that show that the CFPB was communicating with Wells Fargo at least 6 months before Wells Fargo disclosed that this was a problem. So 6 months before September 8th, Wells Fargo never told investors in any of their securities filings that they were being probed by the CFPB, the OCC, or the City of Los Angeles. I talked to a Wharton.
What could the upshot of that be?
What could the upshot be to
The fact that they didn't reveal that to investors?
Well, I don't know. I mean, what I would say is that I talked to a Wharton School professor at the University of Pennsylvania who told me for that story that on the basis of what we know, it's hard to argue this wasn't material.
Okay. Wells Fargo is investigating itself. Nothing wrong with that. But how do bank executives, how does the board have confidence, Emily, in their ability to investigate themselves when their own examiners were thwarted during the course of this bogus account scandal?
That's a good question. I wish we had someone from Wells Fargo or the board on here to answer that one, but I'll take a shot at it. I think that at least what we know from our reporting is that the board basically has been doing an exhaustive investigation, almost starting from scratch, because it felt that what the bank had been investigating on its own over the past couple of years really focused mostly on customers and how customers may have been impacted rather than who was responsible inside the bank. and how high up it went and why this all happened. And so our understanding is that they basically had to start from scratch, and that means going through tons of emails, in-person interviews, phone records. And what's even more complicated is that oftentimes our understanding is that there weren't a lot of emails or documents that were very clearly saying what was done wrong or what was suggested of employees. A lot of it was done in person. And that means even more anecdotal interviews that take much longer to do. Will we know that they're going to do it exactly right? I don't know if anyone will ever quite know that, but I think the reason why it's been taking so long, because if we remember, the board said that they would be doing this back in late September after a ton of political pressure following, congressional hearings, or at least one congressional hearing. So it's a bit about 6 months from then. So you got to hope that they definitely have some answers and have dug deeper to get some sort of understanding of what happened and why.
Charlotte-based Mary Mack is in charge of righting the ship, and she's already making changes, and I know people have been fired. They're changing banking policies and procedures internally, and yet the internal investigation is not over, and I don't believe the report has been released, although maybe she's seen segments of it. Is it premature to make changes before the report is out?
Well, I think that they're trying to do some things. This is, again, I'm speculating here, but they've got this shareholder meeting coming up, mm-hmm. and I think they need to show shareholders that they're doing things, that they're taking steps. There's this shareholder meeting there'll probably be some angst at this meeting. There may be some shareholders who are going to stand up and tell management, what happened? How did this happen? How did you guys let this fester? So there, some of this is probably getting ready for the shareholder meeting and saying, look, we're trying to move fast. We're trying to hold people accountable. Here's what we've done so far. We've eliminated cash bonuses for 8 executives. This was announced recently. No cash bonuses for 2016 for 8 executives, including the CEO, including some executives here in Charlotte, to not say that they were culpable for any of the behavior, Mike, but to say that, look, you guys are accountable for, our reputation. You're accountable for what's happened in the wake of the scandal.
And Tim Sloan, who's the new CEO, has said the bank is fixing things so something like this cannot happen again. What has been done so that it cannot happen again?
I think we could both probably give a long laundry list of various things that the bank has done. I'll just name a few, which is they ended product sales goals back in October. They rolled out a new compensation plan for the retail bankers in early January, and I think we've talked about how that was really at the root of a lot of this, a flawed incentive compensation plan. They've fired publicly and disclosed 4 retail banking executives that they've fired for cause. And since then, we and others have reported that folks 1 or 2 levels down from that in the retail bank have also been fired. And I think, speaking to what Dion said before, like, can Mary Mack make these changes when the board's report hasn't come out yet? I think they have to, because what we have been hearing inside the bank is that, people felt frozen. And that it was a really difficult environment because they're all waiting for the big shoe to drop with the board's results from their investigation. But at the same time, they have to move on. And so one way to do that is by letting out some of these updates, whether it's how compensation has been impacted, some folks who have been fired, changing compensation systems, in order to try to move on, even though, truthfully, until the board's report comes out, will they really be able to move forward, I think.
I'll hop in here, Mike, too, and add one more thing to all the things that Emily just said. The board also moved to separate its chairman and CEO roles. So you no longer have one person holding both the chairman role of the board and CEO. Those are now 2 separate people. You talk about shareholders and why is the bank doing all this. Emily wrote a great story not too long ago about all of the proposals that shareholders have put to Wells Fargo since the scandal to try to get the bank to do numerous things, change some of their practices, make certain disclosures, and the bank I think, Emily, you did the story, so you may want to jump in here, but, you know, the bank tried to knock down some of those, but it was really an unusual number, right, Emily, of requests?
Yeah, it was the highest ever. Thank you for mentioning that. It was the highest number of so-called no-action request letters. In other words, the bank was asking the SEC to essentially agree with them to not put shareholders' proposals on their proxy, which we're expecting any day now to come out. And that's where shareholders propose, you know, different changes or practices, and then they all vote on them to see whether they should move forward. And if the SEC agrees with a company that, you know, it isn't relevant for one reason or another, it blesses the company to not include it on the proposal.
And didn't you write also that shareholders are claiming that that's a tactic to keep out proposals that dig deeper into the causes of the scandal?
Absolutely. That is a tactic that, you know, it's not just banks, but many companies over the years have used to try to disinclude proposals from the proxy and have almost, if you can imagine it, like fewer issues come up at the shareholder meeting that they would like. And, you know, some of them the SEC has agreed to that they don't think are relevant, but some of them the SEC does believe are relevant. So we'll see, you know, on the proxy coming out soon, which proposals are going to be included and what will be voted on at the annual shareholder meeting in April.
The bank's also hired an independent consulting firm to, among other things, I think this is your story, Emily, to talk to employees about sales practices. Why is that necessary? Why does the bank have to bring an outside consulting firm in to talk to their own employees?
So this is one of now many independent outside consulting firms that Wells Fargo has hired. As you'd imagine, this is probably a boon for the consulting industry to try to snatch up jobs when Wells Fargo is trying to dig itself out of this mess. And the latest that we are aware of just from reviewing emails sent to internal employees is that the bank is now having yet another consulting firm interview what we think is going to be several hundred employees to really try to get to the root of what happened with the sales practices scandal, why it happened. So they're still trying to get at that question about 6 months after this all erupted. And that really tells me two things. One, they are trying to figure it out. You got to give them credit for that. But two, it's so complicated that they still don't know.
Okay. Both Tim Sloan, the new CEO, and Mary Mack, who's in charge of writing the ship here in Charlotte, talked about the need to rebuild trust. Given what they've done, given the news about what they've done, given where the stock price is today, does that and the number of accounts that are being maintained at the bank, is that working?
Well, I would say that there are some numbers that the bank has released that shows that things are headed in the right direction, or maybe not. Things aren't as bad as they were. For example, every month the bank has to release a report to shareholders that shows how activity in their branches is. And what we've seen is that year over year, as these reports have come out, customer activity has been down. So that's not good for Wells Fargo, but their customer satisfaction scores, Mike, have been going up. So, and I think those are back at pre-scandal levels. Emily, check me on that. But so those are positive signs. But as Mary Mack told us, there's still work to be done, Mike.
So we have about 40 seconds left here. We all hear that when a company gets itself in trouble, the best way out is transparency. From what they've been doing, would you call it transparency? Emily.
I would. I mean, this is a company that used to have pre-recordings for its earnings calls and didn't have a question and answer session. So to go from that to monthly customer metrics numbers and far more interviews and presentations with executives and releasing, you know, town hall remarks ahead of time, I would say it's definitely quite different than before.
When will all this be over, and could there be criminal charges filed?
When will it be over? I don't think anyone can answer that. And will there be criminal charges? I don't think anyone can answer that either. I will say that you'll continue to hear stories about Wells Fargo and the scandal this year. I guarantee that.
Dionne Roberts is a banking reporter with the Charlotte Observer. Emily Glazer, same with the Wall Street Journal. Thank you both for the hour.
Thank you.